This is WUKY 91.3 FM. You're listening to On the Porch, and I'm your host, Silas House. We're fortunate to have one of the country's most acclaimed poets in the studio with us today. Ada Limon is the author of 5 poetry collections, including Bright Dead Things, which was named a finalist for the 2015 National Book Award in Poetry, a finalist for the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, a finalist for the 2016 National Book Critics Circle Award, and one of the top poetry books of the year by the New York Times. Her new book is The Carrying, which has just been released. Limon's poems are frequently found in The New Yorker and many other fine publications. She is originally from Sonoma, California, but currently makes her home in Lexington. The Carrying is one of the most anticipated books of poetry of the year. And it's no wonder. It's a haunting, mesmerizing collection of poetry that fairly thrums with equal amounts of grit and grace. Thanks so much for joining us, Ada.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, tell the listeners what you want them to know about The Carrying.
I guess I'd say that this book for me is terrifying. and I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. When I'm writing something that I feel passionate about, but also scared of, that's when I feel like the poems are most alive. So I would say that this book for me is my most terrifying book yet. And for me, I think that's a good thing. And I also think that this book is for people who are looking to figure out a way how to balance some of the pain of the world with mm-hmm. the joy of the world.
Yes. I absolutely see that in the book. I could relate to that on so many levels, and we're going to get into some of that. What is the title referring to in your mind? Lots of things, I know, but
The Carrying for me came about when I was thinking about titling the collection. I wanted something that had the gravitas that was expressed in the book. And the idea of carrying and all that we carry with us on a daily basis, and the idea of honoring human capacity felt important to me in the title of this book, where I wanted to explore the many different ways we come to the world, what we bring with us, both our physical pain, our emotional trauma, as well as our grace and our faith and our gratitude and our bits of glorious joy. And so I felt like the idea of carrying was all that we bring with us.
I know some writers who always try to steer clear of articles in titles, like the. And I think sometimes you're exactly what you said. It's especially for a book like this, that article really gives it that gravitas, doesn't it? The Carrying, not just carrying. But you know what I mean? It takes it to a whole new level of largeness for me.
I do. I worried about it, actually. Yeah. I wondered if it should not have the article. And it's the only book I have with it. But it seemed to make sense.
It works.
It also felt like an action to me, right? It's the idea of the carrying that
yes.
we do.
Yeah.
And that it's happening all the time, as opposed to a thing we've carried
exactly.
or, right?
Yeah.
But that it goes on
right.
and it's eternal.
Yeah. And only writers would worry about an article, right?
Da-da.
I mean, right, we're the only ones that stress out about those things. But it really works.
Thank you.
I wondered if you might read the first poem in the collection, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. While you're turning to it, I'll just say that I was in New York last year, and I was on the subway heading from Harlem to the West Village, and a couple across from me, the woman was reading something on at first, I thought she was staring at me, and she was reading something on the wall beside me, and then she elbowed her companion and made him read it, and they both, you could tell, they just loved it, and they talked about it, and then I looked up, and it was this poem, and it was so great, you know, to witness the public consuming poetry like that on the subway, you know, where it's hot, and everybody's pretty miserable, and you're crowded, but then you have this great comfort of poetry, so I love that, so...
Oh, well, first let me also add that I am super jealous of you because I have not seen it on the subway.
Wow.
I have been to New York probably a dozen times since this poem has been on the subway, and I have ridden every train, and for some reason, I have never been in a car where it's been there. So I'm glad that you saw it. And yeah, it was a deep honor when they asked me for this poem. When I lived in New York, I always dreamed of maybe having a poem on the subway mm-hmm. someday, and they brought me great solace when I was yes. traveling from Brooklyn to Manhattan to go to NYU. A name. When Eve walked among the animals and named them, nightingale, red-shouldered hawk, fiddler crab, fallow deer, I wonder if she ever wanted them to speak back, looked into their wide, wonderful eyes, and whispered, "Name me. Name me."
Thank you. Tell us what you were thinking about with this poem. And I would really love to know why you decided to open the collection with this one.
I think as a poet and as a creator of things that where we put things into the world and think about things as a living mm-hmm. and notice things for a living, right. Naming is incredibly important to me. The idea of giving language to the things that we see, mm-hmm. To the objects that we see every day, to the animals that we see every day. I was reading this wonderful book called Braiding Sweetgrass by mm-hmm. Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she gives a TED Talk at one point. And you can find it online, and I believe it's the TED Talk where she says that the average American knows 100 names of brands, but can only name 10 names of plants.
Oh my God, that's really depressing.
Yeah. And so I kept thinking about the idea of naming, but also sort of the hubris of naming, that who are we mm-hmm. to name things? Yeah. Who do, you know, is it really just a bluebird? mm-hmm. Doesn't it have another name that's maybe fantastical? And so I had the idea of also reflecting back and that we are animals too. Right. And I wanted that to be present there. That wasn't it, maybe give them a chance to name us.
Right. And it also works really well because there's so many animals in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how often we encounter the natural world, not only wild animals, but domesticated animals, and also rocks and tomatoes and trees, and there's a lot of birds in the book. Mm-hmm. Do you think moving to Kentucky had some impact on you including more nature in this collection, or at least maybe changed the way you thought about the natural world?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I lived in New York for 12 years prior to coming to Kentucky 7 years ago. And I'm from a more rural area in mm-hmm. California, Sonoma, California, where it's primarily vineyards. And I do feel like I've always been connected to the natural world on a large level. I think it's a big part of my own just spiritual belief, mm-hmm. Our connectedness to all things. All living things. And there is nature in my previous books, but I do think that the landscape here in the bluegrass has really influenced a lot of my work. I've read once that green is the most creative color. Mm. And I think if you're living here, you'll know that we are surrounded by green all the time.
It's a glowing green.
Yeah. And I think it influences books in a big way. I also think that not being in a city and being able to write this book with the luxury of time and a little more space mm. around me gave me a particular insight into spending that time with nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the city you might, you know, walk around the corner to the coffee shop or, I don't know, to have a glass of wine or something, whereas here you'd be more likely to take your glass of wine out to the yard or the garden, right?
Correct.
So it's just, yeah, it's with you more.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed in the book that I just love is there are beetles mentioned mm-hmm. throughout the book. And it's such an interesting image on many layers to me. But I wondered if they represent something in particular for you or if they just, you know, sort of show up on their own organically in the book.
Yeah, for me, I feel like they're a nod to the underneath. You know, they're the idea that they're often burrowing, and that the bugs and the animal life and the butterflies and moths and things that we see on a day-to-day basis, you know, is only half of it, really.
Right.
You know, that so much is at play underneath the soil and underneath our feet that we're not even noticing.
Yeah,
and so
great.
I think the beetle is that underneath thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to ask you to read Sundown and All the Damage Done, partly because a beetle shows up in that. It's one of my favorite poems in the book.
Sundown and All the Damage Done. Nearly nine, and still the sun's not slunk into its nightly digs. The burnt meat smell of midweek cookouts and wet grass hangs in the air like loose, familiar summer garb. Standing by the magnolia tree, I think if I were to live as long as she did, I'd have 11 more years. And if I were to live as long as him, I'd have 49. As long as him, I'd be dead already. As long as her, this would be my final year. There's a strange contentment to this countdown, a nodding to this time, where I get to stand under the waxy leaves of the ancient genus, a tree that appeared before even the bees, and watch as fireflies land on the tough tepals until each broad flower glows like a torch-lit mausoleum. They call the beetle's conspicuous bioluminescence a cold light. But why then do I still feel so much fire?
So this poem really shows us how grief shows up in the book quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that I think about the title, how we are, you know, often, a lot of us are carrying grief.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who have lost somebody close to us, you know, mm-hmm. it's something that you're always carrying, not only spiritually, but it's almost like you can feel it physically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so After the Fire is another poem in mm-hmm. the book that is one of the best articulations of grief I've ever mm-hmm. read. So can you talk just a little bit about why you were thinking about that?
Yeah. When I mentioned earlier the idea of human capacity, right, that we can lose a parent or lose a loved one and then still brush our teeth or get our kids to school or go to work, that amazes me.
Right.
The fact that we can do that
yeah.
is unbelievable. And I think about that all the time, and the idea of carrying, right, the idea of like who we carry with us, not just what,
mm-hmm.
but who.
Right.
And this poem in Sundown, All the Damage Done, is a poem that I actually wrote after a massacre at the Pulse nightclub.
Mm.
And I was thinking about everyone who I had or who was lost in that horrible, horrible massacre, but also everyone I had lost personally.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of seemed like the light of these fireflies were lighting up the individual magnolias. And it suddenly seemed like nature was actually responding with this beautiful natural lit mausoleum. And I was overcome with emotion.
Mm.
And so I think grief is a natural catalyst into the world for me
mm-hmm.
because I feel as if I have to do the work of honoring.
Right.
And I feel like it's one of the reasons I'm still around is to do that work
yeah.
of honoring.
Yeah. For me as a writer, I think one of the most important things to me is the act of preservation,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is sort of similar to that idea of honoring. You
absolutely.
Know? Yeah.
I don't know who said it, but I know there's a quote of a writer saying that writing is a great act of resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, another kind of grief, I feel like a whole lot of us, artists in particular, and in particular anyone who can be seen as the other, I think that we've been grieving a lot over the last couple of years because of the current state of our country. In the book, you reference this a few times, I'm thinking of your poem, A New National Anthem, or the mention that you carry your passport with you all the time because of the threat of ICE. In the poem, American Pharoah, you write, I used to think everything was getting better and better. Now I think it's just getting worse and worse. I'm not sure if that's a reference to the political climate or not, but it's certainly fitting.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel as if you are carrying around grief about that as well?
Absolutely. How could you not be?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're living at a time where every day something seemingly more horrible happens. Right now, with the atrocities that are taking place at the border, and the fact that we haven't started really reuniting mothers and fathers with their separated children, is something I can't stop thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where you almost have to take grief and put it another place in order to live,
right.
In order to eat, mm-hmm. right? To literally survive.
Yep.
And I think that sometimes poetry for me is the answer to where do I put all this?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I put it all?
Yeah.
And if I can put it into a poem, I feel like I've earned another day to keep on going,
yeah.
and to keep on moving, and maybe given someone else or granted someone else that permission to.
Do you think writers have a responsibility to speak up in times of crises like these?
I do. I think that if we're going to say that we value language,
mm-hmm.
that we honor language, that language is the tool that we privilege the most, then I think we really need to look at how we are inundated with hateful language, or how language is being used in our political system or used as a tool of hate. And if you don't really talk about that, I think that there's some part of you that's compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think compartmentalizing is healthy for artists. You know,
right.
I think maybe it can be useful for people who are getting over things and recovering from things. But I think as an artist, we have to stay raw to that, stay tender to that. And if we don't, I think on some levels, we're not doing our best work.
Yeah. In the poem Mastering, you write, perhaps the only thing I can make is love and art. I think that the very creation of art is a revolutionary act in a time of anti-intellectualism, which is sort of what you're talking about here. I really believe we're living in a time where anti-intellectualism is just being celebrated, and that drives me crazy. Would you agree with that notion?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Right? Is when, when do we start burning books? You know, it seems
right.
like that's next.
Yeah. Yeah. So that goes hand in hand with what you said and made me think about that, how, you know, people who deal in language and emotions and all that really do have a responsibility to act on that and
mm-hmm.
to, but at the same time, I think your book does a great job of never being a polemic. You know, it's always about the human story. So I think that's that balance that has to be struck, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons I could never really successfully write polemics is because I don't have any answers.
Right.
And that would imply that I did.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that I had wisdom. But I think that in reality, what I do is have more questions and hopefully keep asking the right questions over and over again, and hope that that connects us in our universal search. You know,
well, there's lots of wisdom in this book.
Thank you.
You're listening to WUKY 91.3 FM. We are visiting with Ada Limon here on the porch. Well, would you say this book is a sort of memoir as well as a poetry collection? Or, you know, I'm not a poet, so I don't quite know how poets define that. But I believe that every poem is from the first person point of view in here. And just knowing a little bit about your life, it seems like lots of times that I that is speaking is you. Or is it not? Is it sometimes a character?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. I feel like with Bright Dead Things and this new book, The Carrying, the I is almost entirely me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why these last two books felt like I needed to do that, but I did. I think that there was something about what's going on maybe in the world or what's going on with myself where I felt like I needed to own my own experience as opposed to maybe obfuscate it a little bit mm-hmm. with a more lyrical setting. So in some ways that can be why I might be more fearful of the collection, because there isn't a line that I can draw and say, well, the speaker, when she was going through this, right? And it's when I was going through it.
Yeah. Well, I think it really strikes a great balance of being very revealing, but also never feeling like navel-gazing, mm-hmm. you know? I think that's a real delicate balance sometimes.
I agree.
And you really pull it off.
Oh, so thank you.
A really good example of that deep introspection is the poem, Love Poem with Apologies for My Appearance. Someone asked you to read that one. I just think it's such a great love poem because it really gets to the heart of true romance is the way I think of it. It's just totally being yourself with somebody else, you know?
Yeah, thank you. I have to sort of preface the poem by saying that the person that writes the poem is often very different than the person that reads the poem. As you know, you've mm-hmm. just been doing such a huge book tour for your new book, mm-hmm. right? We go out there, we perform, you know, we dress up, we talk to people, we're on, right? But when we write, you know, there's probably a chance we wouldn't even open the door if someone knocked. We'd be so spacey. Right. We might not even hear it, right? Because we were listening to the voices in our head. And so this is sort of the idea also, it's a love poem, but also the idea of who I become when I'm really writing mm-hmm. as opposed to who I am when I am performing. Mm-hmm. This is from my husband, Lucas. Love poem with apologies for my appearance. Sometimes I think you get the worst of me. The much loved loose forest green sweatpants, the long braless days, hair knotted and uncivilized, a shadowed brow where the devilish thoughts do their hoofed dance on the brain. I'd like to say this means I love you. The stained white cotton t-shirt, the tears, pistachio shells, the mess of orange peels on my desk. But it's different than that. I move in this house with you the way I move in my mind, unencumbered by beauty's cage. I do like I do in the tall grass, more animal me than much else. I'm wrong. It is that I love you. But it's more that when you say it back, lights out, a cold wind through curtains, for maybe the first time in my life, I believe it.
Now, you said that poem was for your husband, mm-hmm. Lucas, and the book is dedicated to Lucas, but yes. I also noticed that it's also dedicated to Lily Bean. Mm-hmm. So one thing we share is a deep love for dogs.
Definitely.
And so can you talk a little bit about why? Why do you love dogs?
Yeah, for me, there's something about the animal presence in a house that always reminds me that I, too, am an animal. And that I need to do things, right? Sometimes she looks at me and is like, we need to go for a walk. And I think, oh, I do need to go for a walk.
Right.
I often think she's instructing me more than I'm, you know, owning her. She's tending to me. And I think that they have such big hearts. And what they offer to us is this idea that gets us out of ourselves, out of our brains, mm-hmm. you know, and more connected with the body, the heart, the soul.
Yeah, I think they've forced me to be still mm-hmm. a lot more than I would be, because I just, you know, I'll sit down and pet the dogs or just be with the dogs in a way that I wouldn't, you know, as much. I wouldn't just sit down in the yard as often if it weren't for the dogs sort of leading me to that.
Yeah. Or sort of let yourself wander, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are times where you sort of are just petting the dog and realize, oh, a half an hour has passed and I've just spent this time connecting to an animal, being present.
Yeah, and it never feels like wasted time.
Never.
You know? So I really do think that it's one of the things that really helps me as a writer. Mm-hmm. It helps me to create something. Pretty much all the time when I'm writing, I have a dog on me. You know, I have lap dogs, so you know, as much as often they want to be on you.
Yeah, mine is on my next, right next to me.
Uh-huh.
Right next to me all the time, and snores very loudly because she's a pug. So her snore is the soundtrack really for this entire book.
Right. Well, speaking of soundtracks, I always like to ask my guests what music they're loving right now, mm-hmm. that you might recommend to people to look up.
I will say that I have been a poor music listener because when I'm writing, I can't listen to music, because I'm a mimic. And so whatever rhythm is happening in that music, it really influences my line breaks and my poems. So I tend to go really silent.
Mm-hmm.
The house has to be silent. But that said, I will say that I am a little bit of an old school soul fan. And so I am just a huge Aretha Franklin fan. I listen to her all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Otis Redding, Marvin Gaye. And I just go back to them all the time. So I feel like as soon as it's sort of when I shut the door on my writing life and close the door to the office, it's like, oh, then the music comes on, mm-hmm. and then it's movement time.
Right.
So it tends to be music that really moves me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a few artists like that I always return to, you know, always. And Aretha definitely is one of them that you just can't go wrong with.
Yeah.
What about reading? What books do you want people to know about?
You know, I just finished a great young adult novel by the Latinx author Carrie Fountain. She's also a poet, and it's called I Am Not Missing. Mm-hmm. It just came out. I think its pub day was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a marvelous book. And then I just received, I'm very excited about this and just open it, the new book by Damaris Hill, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing.
Mm.
And it's poems that is exploring the incarceration of African-American women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland.
Wow.
And they're first person poems, primarily really moving work.
When does that come out? Soon?
Soon, yeah. It's the advanced copy. So it's out in January.
Yeah. One thing that you handle beautifully in the book is your transition to Kentucky. And I first noticed this about you with your poem State Bird, which was in the New Yorker. And I loved the way that you just wrote about it in a complex way, because a lot of people don't. People who are from here don't, and people who have come here don't. So I really appreciate you not only showing it as a complex place, but also showing your feelings about it as being complex too. That's what we need about any place, is to complexify it, you know? And so one of the poems in the book that does that beautifully is Sacred Objects. If you would read that one for us.
Yeah. This poem is a prose poem, so it reads a little faster.
Mm-hmm.
Sacred Objects. I'm driving down to Tennessee, but before I get there, I stop at the Kentucky state line to fuel up and pee. The dog's in the car and the weather's fine. As I pump the gas, a man in his black Ford F-150 yells out his window about my body. I can't remember what it was. Nice tits, nice ass. Something I've been hearing my whole life, except sometimes it's not nice ass, it's big ass, or something a bit more cruel. I pretend not to hear him. I pretend my sunglasses hide my whole body. Right then, a man with black hair who could be an uncle of mine pulls up in his truck and nods. He's towing a trailer that's painted gray with white letters. The letters read, Sacred Objects. I imagine a trailer full of Las Virgenes de Guadalupe. Concrete, marble, or wood, all wobbly from their travels. all of these female statues hidden together in this secret shadowed spot, on their way to find a place where they'll be safe, even worshipped, or at the very least, allowed to live in the light.
I love that one so much. And one thing that I'm really picking up on it is this one little throwaway thing where you say that he nods to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, that's sort of the opposite of what the other man's doing, mm-hmm. in that this man is just, he's acknowledging your existence,
mm-hmm.
and he's being polite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the complete opposite of this other guy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And so that's what I'm talking about when you, to me, you're showing it as a place where lots of different kinds of ways of being exist. And
yeah.
So I love that about it. So what has been your biggest surprise about living in this area? And I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily be positive or negative, but, you know, what is really, what's something you didn't expect about Kentucky when you were living in California or New York? And you know, because
yeah.
lots of times when I tell people I'm from Kentucky, they have so many misconceptions. I mean, they don't intend to be rude, but just their assumption is rude, you know?
I do.
Yeah.
Just the facial expression alone.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, being from California and then having lived in New York for a long time, a lot of my family and friends are from there. And so when I travel and I tell people that I live in Kentucky, they literally screw up their face into this strange grimace that looks sort of pained, you know, for them, for me.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand.
Right.
And I think very early on, what surprised me most was my willingness to defend it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That I immediately felt like saying, well, you haven't been there. Have you been there?
Right.
It's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Have you spent any time there?
Yeah.
You know, I suddenly realized that I understood why if I had been from here, right, that I would be so staunchly a Kentuckian because
right.
of that, because of that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was painful to see what people's misconceptions were about the state. So I think that was interesting, that I was immediately would sort of hop to Kentucky's defense.
Yeah, I always tell people that the more you have to defend the place you live in, the more you'll love it, you know? Because there are things that drive me absolutely nuts about Kentucky. I've lived here all my life. Number one, the way we vote.
Mm-hmm.
But still there's something about the place that gets in your blood and bones. You know,
yeah.
And I think a lot of it is just the people and that glowing green,
yeah.
You know, and, but that face that people give, what bothers me about it is that to me, no place is that disposable, you know, no place is that repugnant.
Yeah.
But people do that. People will say to me all the time, well, how did you escape? And I'm like, I still live there. And then they'll say, well, why? You know?
Yeah. They really get confused.
Yeah.
And I think the other part of that look that I struggle with is that there's another part where it doesn't feel like they're acknowledging the complexities in their own environment.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
California is a very large, long state. It has many different people within it.
Right.
And if you focus on diversity, right, or if you focus on a writing community and all of these things that we have in Kentucky and in Lexington in particular, you know, you'll see that in comparison to some small California cities or some places upstate New York, right, that we have much more diversity, much more willingness to share and to invite people into our communities. So I think that the other part of it is that it feels like there's not any self-reflection in that screwed up glance of a face that you get when you tell someone that you've moved to Lexington, Kentucky.
Right, right. Well, I can't thank you enough for being here with us today and for this really remarkable collection of poetry. I was really lucky to be able to read it before it came out, and I've been telling everybody about it. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. You know, I'm a huge fan of your work, so it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. You can find Ada Limon's new book, The Carrying, wherever fine books are sold. Be sure to pick it up. I can't recommend it highly enough. Thank you all for joining us for another episode of On the Porch. I'm your host, Silas House. Until next time, be good to one another.